This is Annie from the Maine Humanities Council. I'd like to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas in Maine.
Tess Chapalakal, she is our next speaker, and she's an assistant professor in the departments of Africana Studies and English at Bowdoin College. She received her PhD and MA from York University in Toronto and her BA at the University of Toronto. She's currently completing a book on 19th century African American literature, and she's the co-editor of the critical edition of the novels of Sutton E. Griggs. It's forthcoming. She's also co-editing the collection of critical essays on the life and work of Sutton E. Griggs. So we're very fortunate to have her here today. Welcome.
So during my breakout session, I was talking all about how Zora Neale Hurston would really have frowned upon speaking from the podium. So I'm going to try not to do too much of that. I've got a little bit of some visuals here that I thought might provide you with something of an aid. I'm going to be talking today about Zora Neale Hurston's politics and its resonance today. And that's a really hard thing to talk about because her politics were almost impossible to pin down. Zora Neale Hurston has been called a radical, a conservative, a womanist, a feminist, a Republican, which she was. But I think that as we call her all these things, all these names, give her all these political monikers, we want to think a little bit about first her context. The political context, we heard a lot, I think, from Cheryl about her social context in which she grew up. But I want to talk a little bit about that political context and how it may have informed some of her fiction. And then I just want to open it up to you and to hear what you thought, what you made of some of the messages, the political messages that you found in the novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God. So we've talked already a lot about Booker T. Washington. And Winthrop, very kindly, alerted me to page 142, as you recall, in which she mentions directly Booker T. Washington. So if you want to turn to it in your edition. Booker T., he was a great big man, wasn't he? Here's Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington, as many of you probably already know, was known primarily, he was the great black leader or the great race leader of the time. And when Hurston was born, he was the talk of the town, basically. And his idea for black education was primarily vocational. He continues to be a controversial figure today in terms of what he represents and what he represented in terms of the time itself, who he was then. Booker T. Washington today is remembered as something of an Uncle Tom, a sellout, and in part, those monikers have come to be applied to Booker T. Washington because of our leaders of the NAACP, W.E.B. Du Bois, who Zora Neale Hurston referred to as Dr. Dubious. And she called him this, I think, rightly, because of his theory of the talented tenth, which was basically a model of education that would educate one-tenth of the black population in a sort of liberal arts form in order to bring up the rest, and that this would be the proper way to uplift the race. So what we talked about in our breakout session was a lot about racial uplift theory and what it meant at the time for Zora Neale Hurston, who was coming up as a young colored girl, as the phrase went, and how she understood herself in the world and what being black meant to Zora Neale Hurston. So the NAACP, the National Association of Colored People, the other person here is James Weldon Johnson, who, as some of you might know, wrote the novel, The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, and was also very famous for having been a collector himself of black spirituals from the South and poems He was the first one to anthologize black literature. And Zora Neale Hurston wasn't a big fan of his either. So she was really on the outs in many ways. She is what I would call someone who was out of step with her time. That she was someone who was really thinking differently about the way the black culture, community might understand itself. And it was so far removed from the Du Boisian, Johnson, and even the Washingtonian understanding of what it meant to be black. And what I want to think about a little bit today is how Zora Neale Hurston understood that, understood what it meant to be black in her time. And we talked already a little bit about this. So if Du Bois understood being black as being a leader of the race, Zora Neale Hurston, I think in many ways, understood being black differently. That the race was not meant to be led. Instead, it was to be what she calls in her autobiography, Dust Tracks on the Road, to be a people. And rather than have a leader of a people, to be just a people. And I think this critique of black leadership that she voiced throughout her career, and for which she was victimized ultimately by Du Bois and Richard Wright, as Cedric reminded us already in the earlier session, she had to pay for that. She had to pay for being out of step with her time. And I think the greatest critique of black leadership comes in many ways in this novel and a later novel published in 1942 called Moses, Man of the Mountain. And there, too, a book that Cheryl already mentioned, it is a kind of political allegory of black leadership, what the problems are with black leadership. And we've been talking a lot in our sessions about women, about her being a womanist, feminist, the kind of politics that Janie herself might have had. I want to talk a little bit today about the men. The men who are not in this novel as celebrated, let's say, but for whom we have some kind of critique. So there are three men, really, primarily in this novel: Logan, Jody Starks, and TK. And the one I want to spend a little bit of time dwelling upon is Joe Starks and who he is and what he represents to the community. So I just wanted to pause there for a moment and ask you what you thought of Joe Starks. She is the man, it seems as though, as we discussed in our breakout session, she chooses. She chooses Joe in order to escape from Logan, and she ends up with Joe, and she's with him for a long time, and we think, as Martina had suggested, that this might be the right road for her to go down in order to liberate herself from the constraints of Nanny. What did you make of Joe Starks? Anyone? Come on. What did you make of Joe Starks? Yes?
The Music Man.
The Music Man. Meaning?
The play, The Music Man. He comes to town and marries the librarian.
Okay. All right. So he's a kind of savior? Is that what you mean by The Music Man?
No, a con man.
A con man. A con man. Okay. So how would you describe their relationship and what he does to the town? What his ideas are for that town. Yeah?
Well, I think Janie says it best when she keeps saying that he worships the work of his own hands, and so as long as he can view Janie as a work of his own hands, I mean, he dolls her up and he puts her up on that pedestal and he won't let her work or be human herself or relate to other people. And even any contact, even when other people brush her hair or something, he makes her, you know, bind herself off and remove herself from other people so that she is solely a construct of his own.
Exactly. So he's not a very flattering figure in this novel. He is a source of considerable tension. He thinks at the end, when he dies, that she's trying to kill him with some sort of conjure. Anything else about him? Yes?
Well, he's an entrepreneur and a capitalist and a very successful one. And he does understand the nature of the relationship in a community, what it takes to make a community. There has to be a center. He knows how to provide that center. So he's socially adept at manipulation and organization, both the positive and the negative.
Very good. Entrepreneur, yeah. Capitalist, it seems to have all the makings of a good leader.
Joe Starks looks to me like a good leader.
Chamber of Commerce.
Right. But would you say he's a good leader?
I think he's George Bush in this novel. I think he is trying to live, he's trying to become a leadership model. He's trying to model himself after a leadership that he has seen be successful. So he sees other leaders and looking around them, sees how they behave, sees that they are successful and behaves in that way, mm-hmm. to the point of treating his wife as, from my perspective, how a successful plantation owner mm-hmm. would treat his white wife.
Right. So let me ask you this then. Does it work for him?
It seems to.
It does. It seems to be a very effective program for leadership. And yet, are you dubious, Dr. Dubious, of Joe Starks? What do you, as the reader, make of Joe Starks, even though, I mean, he doesn't have a good death. And if you don't have a good death in a work of fiction, it's not a good sign. So however you lived your life may have been fine. But if you had a bad death, things aren't, we need to evaluate you differently, basically, is what our author is telling us. How do you then, as a reader, evaluate Joe Starks? Again.
He also has that little expression, I God, which I love that. He does think he's God. I got it.
And this is interesting because I wanted to come back to the question that was raised earlier to Cheryl. I think it was Winthrop, or I can't remember who it was who asked it. The significance of the title. Their eyes were watching God and who the God is in this novel. The God is not, I think, the God, capital G God, but I think it also has something to do with how we see our leaders and who our leaders are supposed to be and what our leaders are supposed to do for us. Enter Marcus Garvey, who saw himself as a kind of God and dressed himself up as he thought a true leader should look. Fire and Cloud, a short story that was a precursor to Moses, Man of the Mountain, was a critique of Marcus Garvey. That Marcus Garvey saw himself as a kind of leader that people should worship. And when he was convicted of mail fraud, Zora Neale Hurston applauded and was glad to see him deported, which was a very strange and radical thing to do and to believe at the time, because he was, in many ways, a great leader of black people. I want us to think about what her critique is of black leadership. That she was taking up these black men, these black leaders, in ways that previously had not been done. And so we call her spunky, her word. That she was willing to take these men on. How do we take Joe Starks on? If we understand, as we've already noted, that his method for leading a people was successful, that it actually worked. I mean, he actually organizes these people. Here they are just doing nothing before, and now he gets them to do something. What's so bad about that? Winthrop?
It's all to his benefit, though. It's, the people eventually become very...
louder, I can't hear.
I'm sorry, they become very suspicious of him, It's like first they think of him as a leader, then they realize that, this isn't about us, it's about him. That isn't suggesting he's a good leader. The best comparison I can make off the top of my head is the high school football coach who really doesn't care so much about, what's happening with players and that kind of thing. It's all about him and his glory and that kind of thing. So he has to deal with the Starks. He starts out to me as being this, you're going to like it. He comes along, he rescues her, and yet in the end, he tries to destroy her.
Exactly. So if we have this as our critique of black leadership, that there is something wrong with the way we choose our leaders and what they ultimately do to us, capital U, us, what their effects are. That although there seem to me to be some very positive material effects, i.e. his entrepreneurial capitalist spirit, there are some, you might say, spiritual negative outcomes to the decisions that he forces upon his people. And recognizing what is wrong with this leadership, I think, is part of Hurston's goal, that we start to see these black leaders more critically. Go ahead.
I think part of the criticism is that some of the leader figures that she criticizes, and certainly in the novel, Joe Starks is representative of it, is that he's not being a leader among his people, he's sort of being a leader of his people and just recreating that whole system. He's taking the place of the white man in that all-black town that he, you mentioned sort of being like the plantation owner and making his wife what those plantation owners' wives would have been like. And he also, there's one part where he's having the men build a ditch in front of a store for drainage, and they said, I thought slavery was over.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think at page 50, the last sentence, where they talk about the town, nobody had the temerity to challenge him. They bowed down to him rather because he was all of these things. And then again, he was all of these things because the town bowed down.
Yes.
And so it was, that's the flavor.
And what's the flavor?
Well, that they made the choice too.
Exactly.
It wasn't just him, it was them.
That's right. So insofar as the people are as much, exactly as she says, responsible for having him as a leader, in the same way the people can make a better system. But the question is then, what system would that be? I mean, all we know, whether you're white and black, is that you have leaders. That's how a people is formed, and that's how a people understands themselves. So if you are arguing against or providing a kind of critique of this form of leadership, what's your alternative? What is the alternative to this leadership model that Zora Neale Hurston wants to advocate? What I think she's advocating is this critique, or what a friend of mine calls, a critic, Erica Edwards, calls contesting charisma. That there is something about the charismatic leader, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Jesse Jackson, and Obama, that we understand as being charismatic figures of leadership. And there is, I think, Hurston is suggesting, a problem with charisma, that it is so difficult to contest. You can't contest this charisma, I think she's suggesting, because there is no room for critique. What I think Hurston's novels provide us with is a way to critique these leaders. And it's a way for people, as you say, for people to find a language in order to formulate criticism that might be effective of the things that we do not know. Because what is interesting about her turn to imaginative fiction as opposed to straight anthropology, or what you might call a mighty anthropology, Cheryl, is that what she wants to do here is to find or imagine a different way of being in the world that does not already exist. And that different way of being in the world can only be thought of in the form of literary fiction. The kind of literary fiction she writes is, of course, an imagined world. But the point is simply to employ the imagination to think of something new that doesn't already exist. And for this, I think, Hurston was violently criticized. The fact that we haven't read Zora Neale Hurston for so long, until Alice Walker found her in her garden, I think is precisely because her message had to be muffled in order for these leaders to lead. Because I think that Zora Neale Hurston's critique of leadership that she provides in this and other novels really does take people away from that charismatic leader that is so difficult otherwise to critique. So I want to stop there, really, and just open it up for questions. I know I haven't you know, sort of unpack every aspect of this novel. But I want to close just with that quote on page 89. Oh, no, sorry, not page 89. Right after Joe Starks dies. Page 87. And she says, "This sitting in the ruling chair has been hard on Jody," she muttered out loud. She was full of pity for the first time in years. And pity is a very important emotion for Janie to feel, because it also means that this is the point at which she disengages. She also feels pity for Nanny, and it is at that point that she disengages from her. Jody had been hard on her and others, but life had mishandled him too. Poor Joe. Maybe if she had known some other way to try, she might have made his face different. But what other way could be? She had no idea. She thought back and forth about what had happened in the making of a voice out of a man, then thought about herself. Years ago, she had told her girl self to wait for her in the looking glass. It had been a long time since she had remembered. Perhaps she'd better look. She went over to the dresser and looked hard at her skin and features. The young girl was gone, but a handsome woman had taken her place. She tore off the kerchief from her head and let down her plentiful hair. The weight, the length, the glory was there. She took careful stock of herself, then combed her hair and tied it back up again. Then she starched and ironed her face, forming it into just what people wanted to see, and opened up the window and cried, "Come here, people. Jody is dead. My husband is gone for me." And it is at this moment, I think, that Janie, for the first time with the death of Jody, knows what it means to be free. And if we then are going to understand this as a post-slavery novel, a novel that attempts to put slavery in the past, to bury slavery and to imagine a new kind of life, a new kind of existence that marks some kind of rupture with slavery, this might be it. That this is a kind of new beginning for Janie and for the Black culture or community that she represents as a whole. Questions?
Yeah, Kathy.
When you're talking about a person imagining herself by creating a world of being, are you saying that's a world without politics or beyond politics?
That's a good question.
It feels like that to me. When you were starting your speech and talking about the politics of the novel, I was thinking, I wasn't sure where the politics
in this novel exists.
Yeah.
That's a good question. I mean, because part of what I think is going on in this novel is a critique of the political culture of the moment in which she, Zora Neale Hurston, exists, and the poverty of that politics. And insofar as she's trying to imagine a new politics, I think the move there is from politics to culture, actually. That she does want to get away from a political ideology and toward a cultural one. What I think Cheryl is saying when she talks about a mighty anthropology. That's what I see the transition as. It's a transition from politics to culture. And it's up for you to decide, you know, whether you think that's a good move or a bad move.
Well, it's a semantic move, first and foremost. I mean, culture can have politics embedded in it, but if culture is individuation, if it is self-determined, if it is people defining themselves by their surroundings and the choices they make with some kind of independence, you know, I don't know how to split the hair, but or say semantically what that means. So maybe you can say more about from politics to culture.
Yes, okay. What I think the shift from politics to culture means is that what she wants these people to put their effort in is not to be looking to their God for answers or leadership or what to do, but instead simply to look at themselves, which is why Janie is looking in the mirror and looking at her own Black self and seeing what she sees, but looking at it the right way. That there is a problem with the way she has been looking at herself, because she has been looking at herself through the eyes of others, a la Du Bois's double consciousness notion, and saying, I am not looking at myself that way. I understand how people are looking at me, but I need to develop a way of looking at myself the way I see myself.
And it seems that this ideology, this idea of how to see oneself truly, is very much against the double consciousness model that Du Bois provides. I mean, you know, I totally welcome people to take issue with that. I'm really just trying to make that claim in order to start an argument. So. Other questions about this idea of where the politics in the novel lies and whether or not it disappears? No?
Can I ask another question for somebody else's?
Go ahead.
I just wanted to carry forward on your statement about God being a manifestation of power and who the people look to for definition. What do you do with the title of the book in terms of its...
I'm sorry, I don't know your name over here.
Sarah.
I do what Sarah does with the title, which is basically to suggest that this idea of God is one that is changing, that has a lot, that she's making a kind of critique of God and how you create your God. I think she's trying to present, I think what Cedric was saying before, I think you use the word pantheistic, a pantheistic notion of God as opposed to this omniscient, you know, omnipowerful, whatever, God, to say that it is something that really, I mean, it sounds a little bit cheesy, but that is in you.
That's consistent.
Right.
Yeah, thank you.
A little bit New Testament, I think. I don't know. People can correct me on that.
I think I'm with you there. I'm struggling with how to say what I'm thinking. But I think she steps out of this moment with more... with a self-possession that she didn't have before, having looked at herself, as you say. But the language around her putting on the face that people aren't expecting, mm-hmm. is a cynical view of having gone to God. She talks about you have to go to God, defining herself, and then, but still being able to define how it is she can successfully be herself in the world outside of her door, in the world outside the gate, and deciding, okay, I need to be this person to get this far, and being open to being another person to connect with TK. And so
that's a very strange model of identity. And this, when I present to my students, Zora Neale Hurston's model of identity is being one of choice, that you can actually invent who you are depending on who you're with or where you are. They are shocked and outraged when I say this, because they can't believe that you can do that. You are where you're from. And the whole thing about Janie, about Zora Neale Hurston herself in Dust Tracks on the Road, what she says is, I needed to get away from there. She needs to pick up and go. That doesn't mean that she doesn't come back, because she does, but she comes back as a very different person. And that is that idea of flexibility or self-invention is very much Hurston's notion of what a black identity is that it is something that can, in fact, be invented. What does Zora Neale Hurston do? But she, as I was saying before, she systematizes and catalogs all these things about what it means to be black, how it feels to be colored me. And when she systematizes that, she puts that out there for you. Listen, if you want to do this, look, this is what you have to do. It's not by making it as transparent as she does, she changes the whole conversation on identity. It's not something that you are born with. It's something that you can go out and discover and then put on or take off as need be. And what's so interesting about that, ultimately, is that she creates, in the course of this fiction, choices for Janie, which she is not born with. Janie is not like Nanny, insofar as Janie is going to allow herself to have choices which Nanny never did, nor once, it would appear, nor once for her granddaughter, it would appear. And that's why, ultimately, Janie hates Nanny. And we had a fight about this earlier, which is why I'm pointing over there. So again, you know, I invite you to take issue with this reading. Cedric?
I'm going to take the bay test. But that won't work. And I won't take it because I agree with your thesis. It's a very persuasive reading. In fact, what I want to do is to complicate it and still more, because I think that the figures
in this novel, male figures as well as the 1920s figures, the boys, they're all representatives of progressivism. Mm-hmm. All progressive figures.
Right.
Jody Stark is a progressive figure. So that with regard to culture, for example, where because he's a progressive figure, he brings progress literally to the community.
Yep.
Before Jody Stark, there's nothing. There is no culture, there's no superstructure, there's no porch. There's no porch, exactly. He brings all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And without his very 1920s modernist kind of progressivism,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't work. So these charismatic figures who are so bound up with progressivism are the bearers of culture,
the makers
of culture. Without them, there's no culture. So there's a gap in Hurston's critique. Of these charismatic figures and of culture, because if she wants instead, if her model is, as you're suggesting, that it should be the people, not charismatic leaders, but the people, how you can get to the people without the charismatic leaders? The people left to their own devices don't seem to create anything. So as a prescription for building culture, making culture, maintaining it, the idea that that it should be some democratic, sort of egalitarian, people-centered politics, that doesn't seem to work.
Yeah. Well, that is if your goal is progress of a material sort that you've just described, a la Jody Starks or whomever, that what you want to do is make buildings and roads through churches if need be, but what you want to do is industrialize this area. But what she ends up doing, Janie, and this is where I think the critique of Hurston, as I think you're suggesting, has to come in, which is that's not what she wants. She does not want that kind of industrialization, and this, I think, goes back to your talk around what her relationship is to the environment itself. But I think you're right to exactly complicate what Hurston's doing. Where I would say that she fills the gap in terms of her definition of culture is that she does not believe culture is something that can be created, but that already exists. And what you have to do is go dig it up. Or go, just go to the culture as it exists, as opposed to inventing the culture itself. I think does that get anywhere near?
Yeah, that works for me.
And that's what I think it is. What is happening here is are competing definitions of culture itself, which is no surprise because, of course, as Cheryl reminds us, she's an anthropologist. Yes,
that actually really helps. I was trying to figure out if when Jody dies, that's sort of the charismatic leader. He's the charismatic leader, and Janie's now free. Why then does she choose to follow another charismatic figure in Tea Cake? But when you start talking about the cultural aspect of it, it makes sense because you talk about digging it up, digging up culture. She actually literally goes to the muck with Tea Cake and follows this charismatic leader who helps her to discover the culture that is already there that lets her immerse herself in. They even talk about the Bahamian people, right? In the Everglades that at first are sort of shunned and separate in some ways.
The Seminoles,
Right. Yeah, and so they start doing the fire dance and things like that, and it actually gets brought more into the fold, and so making these cultural connections rather than the Jody Stark sort of charismatic leader who's leading you to material wealth.
Right, and as we discussed in our breakout session, this is hugely problematic. Given, if what we're looking for is some kind of prescriptive solution to the problem of, let's say, black poverty or hunger, just sort of very basic questions, and the solution she's offering is what? Right? I mean, just as you are, that's fine. Or what she says in this novel is just to view it differently. And that's where the aesthetic solution comes in. That what she wants to make is a different kind of literature
in which black figures figure differently, where they are represented in such a way as they are made to seem beautiful as opposed to what they are without the accoutrements. And I think that that's part of the project here. But you had a point in the back.
I was just going to say that to corroborate all this, Tea Cake seems sort of like the most homegrown, natural, charismatic leader born naturally from the people. He doesn't arrive and create the village and the progressivism and then, you know, the building and construction. He just sort of comes out of the swamp, makes do. And that whole scene with the $200 and feeding the people and all the chickens, and it's such a, you know, seemingly waste of, you know, Jody's money, but it's so sort of symbolic of that sort of natural leadership that's of the people.
Right.
And that contention of charisma, but she's so taken by him.
Mm-hmm.
Just as she was originally by Jody Stark.
So do you think that Tea Cake then in the end is our model of black leadership?
I hope not.
Yeah. I know! Go ahead.
It seems to me that idyllic time down on the muck only lasts as long as the gender balance is in harmony. It is Tea Cake and JD are a couple around which the community gathers.
Mm-hmm.
And that their harmony or their love or their security with each other creates this musical, creative,
mm-hmm.
the kernel around which everything gathers.
Mm-hmm.
And it holds as long as that holds, sort of, or until nature puts the whammy on it with a big storm. It interests me that it seems to me to go back to the first page of the novel where we have what men do and what women do, and they're it, and if there's a solution, maybe it has to do with how men and women will be in harmony.
That's probably right. I mean, because a huge part of this novel definitely is that equality between the races can only happen when there is equality between the sexes. And that is also a very important intervention that Hurston obviously makes, which Walker and others pick up upon, which is so removed from the big writers, the major writers, you might say, of the Harlem Renaissance, that she really wants to make that point, and she does repeatedly. So even in her subsequent fictions, in Moses, Men of the Mountain, a lot of it is the relationship between Moses and his wives that he has in that novel. Sorry, there was another hand that I saw? Yeah.
I was just going to say that you were talking about the balance between the races, and you were talking about ecology and women, sort of the radical ecofeminism where you're not, you have that, I guess there's the dominance of women and all of that, and I just was thinking about how TK, he has that moment where he hits her out of jealousy, and the next time you see him in a sort of jealous rage, it's because he's rabid, you know, and it sort of says something about that charismatic leader who starts out with that gender balance and that
this is where it can get you
thing, and then gets, I don't know, bit by a rabid, you know, the mad dog of patriarchy, and decides to start putting the woman under the boot, I guess. And then she has to kill him, which I don't know what that says to us.
I think it says quite a lot, actually. Yeah.
On page one,
yes.
Second paragraph, the first mention of women.
Mm-hmm.
Now, women forget all those things they don't want to remember, and remember everything they don't want to forget. The dream is the truth. They act and do things accordingly. This is a novel of domestic violence in the extreme. There's certain things that in order to know, you have to go. If you haven't been there, you don't understand it. So she starts at the very beginning telling Phoebe what it is that happened. She starts with her childhood, but she only tells the things that she wants to remember. She leaves out most of the violence. It all gets glossed over. The muck is just a metaphor for the relationship. The hurricane is the, you know, the continuation of all of that.
Right. So when you say domestic violence, are we talking specifically about a relationship between a husband and wife, or between men and women?
We're talking about a spiritual malaise that affects slaves. In a slave society, everybody is a slave, including the masters. the real masters are the standards by which everybody tries to measure up, as purported by the church, mm-hmm. or just society in general, the industrialization. Mm-hmm. The only way out mm-hmm. is to get away from the judgment of ourselves. When we don't measure up, we judge ourselves. That leads to the low self-esteem and the progressive nature of this. She starts out with Killick, and then goes to Starks, and then ends up with TK. There's a downward progression. But when she looks in the mirror, there is a change, like you mentioned, but it's not until the very end that she actually finds peace. Mm-hmm. And that's when she finds acceptance instead of judgment. This is a brilliant portrait of the human condition.
Mm-hmm. Well, with that, I will turn things over to Martina.
Victoria? Any other questions for Tess?
Any others?
Thank you, Tess.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.